Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 18, delivered on April 7, 2011. The title of this lecture is Preferred Stock.
Today, Preferred Stock. Last couple of words about bonds. There are many different kinds of bonds. Certainly over the past 30 years, there was obviously some better bonds than others. I personally, Sean Connery as Bond was very good. But now they've got that Craig Williams, and he's not bad. But, oh, anyway, bonds. First thing I can do is I can distinguish bonds on dimensions of whether they are collateralized or uncollateralized. In other words, if you are a lender, do you have an asset that you can claim directly, or would you just be in the regular pool of those waiting for something that was left after the smoke had cleared? Now, if it's a bond that has some kind of asset backing, we would generally refer to that as a mortgage bond. A mortgage bond. Now, just to give you a little bit of technical background of the I just very briefly, whenever you borrow money, and we'll take this as you as a consumer, the borrowing itself, the instrument of borrowing, is called a promissory note. And note might be inappropriate there if it's longer than 7 years. But we call the borrowing document a promissory note. Now, attached to that could be a mortgage document. That is a document that represents a piece of collateral that can be claimed by the lender in the event of default on the mortgage or on the promissory note. Now, when you borrow on a house, it's just automatic there will be a mortgage attached to the promissory note. However, with corporate bonds, there might or might not be a mortgage that is attached. If there is, it's called a mortgage bond. If there's not, we would generally refer to it as a debenture, a D-E-B-E-N-T-U-R-E-S, debenture, and not to be confused with dentures. You don't need dentures. You will someday if you don't floss. Here we go. Now, so you can distinguish bonds by whether they are collateralized. Now, obviously, if it's collateralized, it will be lower risk, and so you would tend to see two bonds from the same company that were otherwise in all ways equivalent with respect to the covenants of the bond. If one of them is a mortgage bond and the other is a debenture, you would anticipate that the coupon on the mortgage bond would be lower than the coupon on the debenture. That's one way you can divide them. Now, you can get into this world of subordination of bonds. You can have bonds that are senior. They would be the first to have a claim on assets if the company goes tap city. Then you could have subordinated bonds. They would be behind the senior bonds in terms of who would get provided any money that was there in a liquidation. Then you could have lower, various grades like junior bonds, junior subordinated debentures. It can be all over the place. And it's a logical structure as far as risk goes. The higher your order is in claim, obviously the safer your bond is, and the lower the coupon would be. So you can see senior subordinated, junior subordinated, seniors, just all kinds of different things out there. And it's just kind of a logical structure as far as if it's a junior bond, it's going to be riskier than a senior bond. But remember that if the company is a going concern and there's not a whole lot of risk that it's going to go out of business, these bonds are generally going to be only a shade of difference in risk, because the company will probably be able to satisfy all of its debts in a timely manner. Remember that bonds, through their life, are serviced. The interest is paid on the face value. And then at the end, the face value is paid in one big lump sum, along with the last interest payment. Now, most covenant agreements for bonds will make sure that the company has the money to pay off the bond. That means that the company will be required to put money into a reserve pool over the life of the bond to make sure that the money is there to pay off face when the bond comes due, when the balloon happens. So that would be there. It's not like they're just going to hope the company has the giant face value to pay off the principal at the end of the life. The bondholders will insist that there is a sinking fund that will have money going in every year to ensure that the money is there to pay off the principal at the end of the life of the bond. There's another way that it's done sometimes. They're called cereal bonds. And of course, there are sugary cereals and high-fiber cereal bonds. No. Cereal bonds are bonds you need, let's say, $10 million. But serially, they will be issued one year, this is a simple example, $1 million 1 year, to another million the next year, another million the next year. So they will retire in a serial fashion, so that is a way that the company wouldn't be hit with a massive payoff on 1 year. It would happen over a period of years. So serial bonds are a way that companies can give the bondholders the assurance that the money will be there. Now, there are two special types of bond animals out there that I mentioned them before, at least I think I did, one of them. One of them is what is called a callable bond. Now, callable bonds are adverse to the investors. Callable bonds are essentially like, in home mortgages, they're like refi. The right of refinancing. A callable bond is a bond where the company that borrows the money from the bondholders has the right to pay off that bond early. And oftentimes they can't call it right immediately. There's a time frame when they're not allowed to call. But it would be like this. Suppose that you're a company, the interest rate environment was such that on a risk-adjusted basis, you needed to issue bonds at an 8.5% coupon. But interest rates have gone down, so you would have the right with a callable bond to pay off that bond and then reissue new bonds at a lower coupon rate. Well, now the lender is not going to be, the bond holder is going to be rather pissed about that, because I lent the company $10 million at 8.5%. I expect for the next 30 years, if it's a 30-year bond, to get an 8.5% coupon every year for 30 years. But if the bond is callable, I could end up getting my money back early, and because it was called, since interest rates have gone down, I end up having to reinvest my money, relend it at a lower rate. That sucks for me. So if the company wants a callability provision in the bond, I'm going to say to the company, you know what? You're going to have to pay me a higher coupon to start with. Let's say 9%. Because there is a good chance that I am not going to see my expected yearly check of $85 for the next 30 years. You could refi on me and give me back my money, in which case I'd have to lend out again at a lower rate. So you know what? As long as you are paying on this bond, you're going to pay me 9%, because there's a good chance that I'm going to get my butt kicked by you down the road. Those are callable bonds, and so they have a higher risk, and therefore there will be a higher coupon on them to reflect that investors are going to expect a little extra for the chance that there's going to be a refi on it, that the company will call the bond. Now, here is another twist, the convertible bond. Now, this one is not fun, because a convertible bond is a bond where the company, if it gets in a lot of trouble and it can't pay its coupons, it can turn the bond into stock. So that means that I, as a bondholder, you see, a bondholder is like a one-night stand. Well, not a one-night stand. It's like a, it's one of those things where, you see, I could get married, which is forever and ever and ever and ever. No, or I could just go to Craigslist and hire a friend for the night. It might be ugly, but in the morning it's gone, and I can chew my arm off. Where the hell was I? Okay, so you see, a bond is like Craigslist. It's not going to last forever. It's just 30 years, 20 years, and then I'm done with it. Gone. With stock, it's there forever. So you see, as a bondholder, I know my relationship with the company is going to last 30 years. But if this is a convertible bond, that company could say, you know what, we can't pay you your coupons anymore, so we're going to turn you into stockholders. Which really, really sucks on one level, because I'm a bondholder. I don't want to be a stockholder. I want prior claim, not residual claim. It sucks on another level too. If that company is in so much trouble that it cannot pay its coupons, that means that I become a shareholder in a company that is called the SS Titanic, and it's already on its way down, and I am having to deal with the prospect of Kate Winslet winning the Oscar, and all I get are the deck chairs. Convertible bonds are risky business, because that company is already saying, you know what, we have a feeling we might not be able to make our interest payments someday, so we want to have this option of turning you into stockholders so we can all go down together. No, that I'm going to punish that company. You want that kind of a provision, you're going to pay me a pretty hefty coupon for that. Higher risk, higher expected return. It's funny how that works. Now, there's one last one I'll bring up in bonds. It's called the ZCB, the zero coupon bond. Now, remember I told you that the term junk bond is just so 1990s. We prefer to say that a bond is not investment grade. Well, when you're talking about zero coupon bonds, they are so not investment grade that they suck. Here's how a zero coupon bond works. A company would oftentimes be a company that is a startup. It's not going to have any revenue for at least a couple of years, but it needs money now, and it wants to borrow money now. So what it will do is it will ask a lender like me, look, we need to borrow $1,000 and we'll pay it all off in one shot 7 years from now. You sell us a deep, these are sometimes called deep discount bond. You sell us a bond. You lend us $400, and in 7 years, we'll pay you $1,000 back. Hence the name zero coupon, because there's no coupon. You just lend them a little money, and 7 years later, you hope to God they've got their act together, and they can pay you back that $1,000. Okay, you got the hang of a zero coupon bond? Again, they're also called deep discount bonds, because essentially the bond is selling at a deep discount to par. So in real terms, I can think of it, here's how the math of a zero coupon bond would work. Dang, there, huh. Oh, here, I already had one up there. Watch. You see, let's say it's In 7 years. You see, that sucks.
We can't even see the 7.
Oh, what the heck? You know what? You know, that's making me want to hurl every time I do that. Okay, here. Okay, suppose that, let's work it out. This is a 7-year ZCB. I'm going to lend the company $400 now, and the company's promising to pay me back $1,000 in 7 years. The price of the bond is $400. It's a deep discount bond. Now, here's how I work the math of it, okay? The price, the face, the dollars interest, the yield. Remember how I did, this was how I did it when I did those 1-year treasuries? The price is going to be $400. What's the face value of the bond? $1,000. So what's the interest that I'm going to earn?
$600.
So my yield on this bond, is going to be the dollar interest over the initial investment. That's how I always calculate yield. But this is a 7-year yield. I'm going to have to do some fixing once I do this. Because what I'm going to have to do is raise this to the 1/7th power. Uh-huh. You want to talk Butch? Then I subtract 1. And if I do that with this zero coupon bond, I will get 600 divided by 400, and then I'm going to raise that 7, 1 over x, you just hit the negative 1 button, that reciprocal button. Try that again. Clear. 600 divided by 400, y to the x, 7 reciprocal equals minus 1 equals, and then times it by 100 to get a percentage. My annual yield on this bond times 100 will be 5.96%. If it pays off, of course. But that's how you calculate these bonds. It will always be just like it was. The only part that you didn't see when I did this, remember back in the early days of this course when we were all young and happy and we loved each other? It was so beautiful. I think back on it to this. Oh. When I did treasury bills, you remember I did the dollar interest divided by what you paid, and then I subtracted 1. Well, it's the same thing here, except there it was 1-year bond, so you didn't see that one reciprocal trick. So the formula here is that the yield will be the dollar interest over the price you pay for the bond to the 1 over the number of years the bond rolls minus 1. And then don't forget to times it by 100 to turn it into a percentage. It's actually the same thing that I did with that 1-year treasury bill early in the course, except that you didn't see the power there because it was just a 1-year thing. Now it kind of shows up. Generally speaking, zero coupon bonds, these ZCBs, showed up a lot during the era of the junk bond salesman, the Michael Milkens. Companies that were startups had very little chance of ever making it. They were pumping out these zero coupon bonds, making promises to investors. Look, it'll be a few years before revenues start, but once the revenues start, this thing will be a cash cow. Well, you know what? It turned into a dog. There was no moo. There was just a lot of whimpering and whining by investors because these companies just went out of business within a few years. There was nothing there, not even any assets to claim. These the lenders were just left high and dry completely. Hence, they got the name junk bonds. But now we say they're not investment grade. And yeah, there are still ZCBs out there being issued, even now. And I was actually, sometimes I just focus too much on certain parts of markets. I didn't think about these actually being still out there. And I, sure enough, there are still companies that issue ZCBs. Quite risky, quite risky. Now, I'm going to go on. Preferred stock is actually a very easy subject. There's just a little bit of math in it, and I'll just cover it. It takes about 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes. Preferred stock is equity. It is like common stock in the sense that the preferred stockholders have the residual claim. They are not debt holders. But they are in a superior position to common shareholders because the dividend that is paid to preferred shareholders, first of all, is a stated dividend in the preferred stock covenants. It has to be paid before the common stock can have a dividend. And if it is cumulative preferred, that means that it would be all of the dividends to the preferred would have to be caught up before any dividend to a common share would ever be paid. Now, if the dividend to a preferred share isn't paid, that doesn't mean the preferred shareholders can do anything, but they can't except to block payment of dividends to the common shareholders. Preferred stock works like this. It has many features, much like bonds, in the sense that a preferred share will have a par value, and it will be a big number. Like, let's say, for example, it would have a par value of $100. It would also have a stated dividend. It would be called, say, 2% GMX preferred, which means that that 2% refers to the par value. So you have to watch the par value to know what the what you're going to get for a check. In this case, every year, forever, you will get $2 for every share, forever. As long as you hold the stock and as long as the company can pay it. It's essentially, it's a fixed income investment. It will never go up in value. Well, I shouldn't say that. You're never going to have the dividend grow. The dividend will not grow like a common dividend could. The dividend would never shrink unless the company can't pay dividends. Common dividends could go down if the company just wants to cut its dividends. But a preferred share states, this is what you will get as a percent of the par value of the share that you bought. Now, let's talk about the price of a share of preferred stock. It's really an easy formula. It's a perpetuity. A perpetuity, in other words, the price of preferred stock is going to equal the dividend, which doesn't grow. There's no D0, D1. It's just a dividend forever and ever and ever, over the discount rate for the cash flows on the preferred stock forever. That's it. No minus G. There's no growth. It's just one number forever. So let's say the discount rate on 2% GMX preferred is 2.3%. What's the price of GMX preferred? And it's so easy. All you do is you just say the price. My dividend is $2, right? You just say 2% times the face value, the par value. So it's $2 divided by 0.023. That's all you do. 2 divided by 0.023 comes up to be my answer. Oh, 86.96. Is that right? In other words, this preferred is selling at a discount to par. You even use the same terminology. Why is it selling at a discount to par? Because the market says it should be paying 2.3% and this coupon is only 2%. So it sells at a discount to par. Try this. Suppose that 2% GMX discount rate is 1.8%. I'll bet you the price, it will sell at a premium to par now because the market said it needs to pay 1.8%. The dividend is 2%. Let's see. Price would be the $2 dividend divided by, in this case, 0.018. Well, $111.11. It sells at a premium to par. Because the market says it needs to pay 1.8%, but it's paying a little more. Let me give you one that's kind of... Now, actually, interestingly enough, you kind of say, well, you know what? That dividend, that it kind of sucks, $2. And I bought it for around 100, up or down from that somewhat. You know what? It's a fixed investment. That's a stream forever. And like I said, you oftentimes will see this kind of an instrument in certain kinds of portfolios. Like, for example, older people would tend to have bonds, yeah, but they would also quite possibly have preferred stock. And here's... I think I already said this, but I'll say it again here. The reason is quite simple. When you are a bond investor, sooner or later the bonds pay off. 10 years, 15, 20, 30, whatever. Sooner or later the money comes back to you. And then you have to reinvest it. But with preferred stock, that's not going to happen. It's just going to be there forever. As long as you want to keep that stock, you will never have to reinvest. The dividend will just come to you every year, year in and year out, forever. So in that way, it actually has a great deal of attraction to some investor classes. Now, here's the challenging thought. Taking that off the board. When I talk to you about investor classes and all of that, some of you will one day take a course from me in options, futures, and derivatives. And most of you will be smart enough not to do that. But in the world that we're in now, I can teach you how these things, anything that I show you, I can, when it goes out there, like for example, you get a home mortgage. You finally have lived, you're achieving your dream. You borrowed for a double wide trailer. You borrowed $50,000. You needed some money for a nice decorative skirt for it. I prefer a hula skirt, but that's just me, you know, the 60s and grass and all that. But I said that on you, oh, gee. Okay, But you see, once you have borrowed that money, I can promise you that within hours, if not sooner, that mortgage, that promissory note, really doesn't exist except in your mind. Because what we do, what the world of finance does now, is they take those instruments and they break them up. They tear them up into all kinds of different pieces. You see, there are some investors who like a stream of cash coming to them. That would be the payments. There are some investors who prefer just a big lump of money in 7 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever. Those kinds of investors, we would want to break up the mortgage along with a whole pile of other mortgages so that we had a new instrument that was nothing but the stream of payments and another new interest that was nothing but when the people were paying off their payments. And then we could even make it more complicated than that. For years and years, as a teacher of real estate finance, the big thing that we talked about was affordability of owner-occupied housing. It's a huge thing. People have wanted forever to borrow, and they just couldn't do it because they had to make that down payment, and it was always too steep for a lot of poor and working-class people. And so a world developed of financial instruments that could satisfy this desire people had for houses, desire of people who couldn't meet normal requirements as far as down payment goes, as far as credit worthiness goes, as far as grace in their ability to control a calculator go. Do you know the name of the market that we finally developed for those people who wanted so badly to have houses, and we finally found a way to do it for them? Does anyone know what that market was called for those kinds of mortgages? No. Don't ever use the word bubble with me. I will flame the lace on my boxers. In a manly sort of way, you understand. But what was the name of the market? Does anyone know what we called that market? It was called the subprime market. Well, spank me, Jesus. We are the evil ones. We who constructed a market that could satisfy what those people wanted. And then when that market went tap city, well, spank me, Jesus, again. You're hurting me, Jesus. You know what? Guess what happens when you lend money to people who have bad jobs, bad credit, and no down payment? They go bankrupt. Oh, well, isn't that a shock? You evil, evil finance professors who taught how to do this kind of pricing of instruments. You evil mortgage lenders out there who did this to these poor sons of bitches. That's, you see, the problem is, you see, we can do magic. We can break up instruments for different classes of investors. We can create an ability for anyone to borrow money for anything, even for you to own that double-wide trailer with the Elvis Velvet paintings in it that are so tasteless, your dog won't even come in the house. He stays outside.
Oh, poor Fluffy.
Fluffy, for God's sake. You need a dog with a man name. You know, Rover, Fido, Killer. Dennis. Dennis? But you understand, what I teach you here is actually a very simple world. But out there, once debt instruments go out in the market, and they usually get broken up in so many different ways that you as the borrower on a mortgage, you're issuing a bond. And you would imagine that that bank that you borrowed it from is going to take care of that for the rest of your life. The bank is just going to be a front, a servicing agent that will take your payments. But once it has taken your payments, those go to very complex organizations like Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, Freddie Mac, places where those payments are torn apart because your mortgage was put into a giant pool of other mortgages that were all busted apart so that they are unrecognizable anymore. So all we have that you, for what you see, is something that actually doesn't exist after a few hours. And so as you go in to get that mortgage loan, imagine that what you're doing is you are seeing a picture. That's not what's really happening behind the scenes. What's happening behind the scenes is a complex breakdown, because the world of investors is a world of risk groups, risk preference groups. Some investors want lots of risk. Some investors want low risk. Some investors want timing risk. Some investors want level risk. And so we break up these instruments right behind the looking glass so that they are not anything like what you imagine them ever again. But that's okay, because you can still see the fantasy that there is actually a mortgage out there. There ain't. It's gone. As soon as it gets sucked into that great black hole with all the other ones that were done that day or in the last couple of hours. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.